Hello and welcome to CodeBytes, sponsored by Search 5.0. And today we're excited to welcome our first American guest in Prateek Patel to the show. Prateek plays a leading role in the development team for Azure, which acts within the Java and cloud space. Prateek has a great track record of building successful technology teams and products from startup, scale up to large global organizations. Prateek is also chairperson of DevNexus, which is North America's largest Java conference. So this has all the ingredients to be a fantastic conversation, and I hope you enjoy. Prateek, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Hey, happy to be here. Looking forward to it.
Brilliant. You are our first honorary American guest along with our first ever YouTube Live. So that's a great combo.
Oh, that's fun. Haven't done a YouTube Live in a while, so this would be great. Let's do
brilliant.
It.
Brilliant. Brilliant, Prateek, we always love kicking things off. And if you can just share an overview of your experience to date for our listeners, that would be great.
Yeah, so let me start from the beginning. I actually used to work in the City of London, right by Liverpool Street Station, for a couple of the big investment banks there. That was early in my career. And then moved back to the US and worked at a couple of large companies and have done some startups along the way. And right now, I work at a small to medium-sized software company called Azul Systems, which is in the JVM Java space. And I lead the developer relations team there. So in terms of experience, I've done everything from small three-person startups to working for gigantic companies and a little bit of stuff in between, and have done everything from software development to software architecture to CTO at a small startup, et cetera. So I have a fair amount of varied experience in different sectors.
Brilliant, brilliant, Prateek. And you're a Java champion and quite well known and recognized for doing so. And you do quite a lot within the community and within the event space. Prateek, can you give us a bit of a flavor of what that looks like?
Sure. So I'm currently the president of the Atlanta Java User Group, which is one of the largest Java user groups in the world. It's a local organization, but we also put on a community-run Java and cloud and everything now, it feels like, event called DevNexus, where we used to, before the pandemic, we had about 2,500 people at the event. We're expecting about 1,500 this year as the event is coming up in a couple of weeks. So things are still kind of slowly recovering from the COVID pandemic era, as it were. But yes, I'm also a Java champion. I've written a few books on Java, was fortunate enough to be recognized by the other people in the Java universe and got nominated about 6 or 7 years ago as a Java champion. So
brilliant. Great background, Prateek. And grateful to have you on here. And Prateek, we always like delving into success influencers within tech leaders. I'm keen to learn, what would you say is your success influencer?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. To be honest with you, like a lot of people, you go through this cycle of hyper productivity and hyper work, and then you kind of burn out, and then you say, you know what, I'm just going to take a step back and just do a job for a while. And then you kind of, you know, get back into the game. So I've done that several times. When I was working in London, I was working on a very high performing team, building stuff that was very futuristic. Actually, we built when I was at Deutsche Bank, we built probably one of the first internal platform as a service types of software that was used internally at Deutsche Bank back in the time. This was over 20 years ago now. And then, of course, a few years after that, things like LoudCloud, Heroku, and then, of course, AWS came out. So we were on the leading edge building that stuff. And that was a lot of fun. And, you know, we were working very hard at the time, but we really enjoyed what we're doing. And I think that's the key message that I can give, especially to younger developers or younger people in the tech world, is, you know, you may not be super passionate about what you're working on right now. You know, say if you're working at a big company or something like that. But even at a big company, I feel like there are opportunities where someone who is willing to take a little bit of a risk, stick their neck out a little bit, propose some kind of change that will really help the organization to advance their career. So if you don't mind, I'll give you a quick example.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I first moved back from London to the US, I landed here in Atlanta. Actually, I'm wearing the official ATL hat right now. So, but I started a company called AT&T. You may have heard of them. They're one of the major telcos in the US, obviously. And I was hired as a Java developer over there. We had a bunch of experience building stuff with Java EE and Spring. Spring was a relatively new thing at the time. And when I came into it, I kind of looked around and I was like, why are we spending so much time on collectively as a team trying to build our software just for testing, never mind even production, right? So I went to the person I worked for and I said, hey, this is silly that we have to spend, not just me, but every developer on the team has to spend so much time trying to just do a build so that QA could go test it. Right. We're not talking about hours here. We're talking about days every week, right? Collectively. So I said, look, instead of having you work, having you have me work on building out this feature, why don't you give me 2 months to go and refactor how we do our build process and automate everything so that it can free up all this time? And it was a bit of a risk from my point of view, right? There was things that I was working with that I wasn't familiar with. We were using something that goes way, way back in history called PVCS. It was one of the, let's say, original version control systems. Nowadays, as you know, Stephen, we use, like everyone uses Git, right? So this is way before Git. And I said, okay, I need to figure out how this PVCS thing works, how I can automate it. I spent a lot of time doing that. But basically, it was a collection, honestly, of just like some bash scripts and some other like duct tape and glue. I hate to put it like that, but it worked, you know? So at the end of the day, it would save at least 2 to 3 developer days per week out of a team of 20 engineers. And that was 2 or 3 developer days that could be used after I finished that project to actually work on features, right? So anyways, getting back to my point, finding things which are inefficient like that in the team that you're working on, even if you're working at a big company, it may not seem like it's glamorous or sexy or something like that, but it helps you personally in your career. And of course, it helps you, your teammates, and it helps you also doing your work because you can take this tedious type of stuff that you're doing and automate it, right? That's what we do as computer people, is that we automate stuff so that you don't have to do things manually. But anyways, that's just a quick story. To help the listeners out there, especially the younger ones who are new into this field, you know, you may land a job at some, you know, big box company, doesn't matter who it is. And you may think, wow, this is kind of boring and stuff, but you can make an impact in these places, right? And I think actually it's easier to make an impact at a place like that than a lot of people feel like. It just requires a little bit of persistence. It requires you put in some of that sweat and blood, as they say, but it's totally possible. And you know, it helps your career. It helped me become a lead architect in short order at that specific job because they saw what I was able to do with that. And then when other things came up, it's like, well, hey, go ask Pratik. He's good at coming up with creative solutions and helping us be more productive as a whole. So that quickly led, within a few years, for me to become the head of the Java performance engineering team at AT&T. So I did that for many years. I helped solve these large scale problems that we were having. I had a bunch of people who were on my team who did, amazing work to help us get there too. So, it's a lot of it is teamwork, but a lot of it is also that personal type of effort that you have to put in to be able to make change. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a good learning here, Pratik, where if you do see anything, tedious or anything monotonous, it's always an opportunity, isn't it? So that's where you really get your enjoyment from. And you're right, those bigger, large organizations starting off, perhaps, it can still bode very well, for your career pathway, Pratik. Pratik, you've obviously a very, very interesting profile and background, large investment banks, startups. If you were to reflect on your career, what would you say has been the biggest challenge that you've had to overcome?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I would say that there's probably not just a single challenge. There's always multiple challenges, right? Especially when you work in different types of companies, right? From the startup to the medium size to the large company. So I spoke about the large company before. So let me just reflect on that quickly. A large company generally tend to move slow, and they generally tend to be risk averse. That's just the nature of any large company, right? The challenge that you face there in trying to, you can look at this from a number of different points of view. You can look at it from your own personal career point of view, as well as how can you help move the needle forward at where you're at. The larger companies will generally tend to have a lot more red tape, as you would call it. They also would have a lot of people internally who would resist those types of changes. So at large companies, the challenge is trying to fight through that red tape, and probably bigger is trying to convince people who have been there for a while that change is necessary, right? And this is one of the challenges I faced when I did multiple different projects, both at Deutsche Bank and at AT&T, was how do I convince people, especially people who are stakeholders, that it's worth taking a risk to do this, okay? And the way that I always tried to frame this to people to make other developers understand, right? Or to not even just developers, development managers, business analysts, all those types of things. And I think it's much easier now. And the reason is that, or the way the tack that I took here is that technology is always changing. Okay. Yeah, we go through like our curve where things are changing very rapidly, and then we kind of like, not changing too much, right? We went through that about, let's say, starting 10 or 12 years ago with this whole journey and transformation to the cloud, right? Everything seemed to change at that point in time. But again, I think if the advice I would give to folks is that if you're faced with these types of challenges, couching it in very simple terms, like technology is always changing. And if we want to protect our jobs, right, we make it a collective type of thing. If we want to protect our jobs, if we want to do what's right for the organization we work for, then we have to be able to adapt. The adaptation may be slow or it may be fast, but we have to always be on that mindset where the tech is changing, so we have to change the way that we approach things, whether it's optimizing things or fixing problems or whatever it may be. And I think using that kind of argument with other developers tends to work really well because developers understand, at least in the back of their head, that yes, tech is always changing. And yes, we do need to adapt. We do need to learn new things. We do need to sometimes change our process in how we do it. We can't change it all the time, obviously, right? You can't change your process every year or every 6 months, right? You have to change it though, and you have to change it for the better. So I think that's kind of the big thing, right? From the big company point of view, from the small company point of view, the challenge is always trying to stay. Again, this is more of a startup to small company type of environment you're working in. The challenge is almost the opposite of that, is you want to change things all the time, right? Whether it's in your product or whether it's in the way that you work or whatever, right? It's, startup, small companies are a totally different ball game. So I think from that point of view, it's coming up to a decision on a technology platform or the way that you approach things, or even the way that you approach customers and sales and features, and saying, okay, you know what, we feel like we need to change this, but let's take a step back and let's look at the longer arc of where we're going in this company for the next month, 6 months to a year. And okay, so this customer really wants this feature. They'll buy our product if we build this feature out. And we would love to, of course, acquire, have this customer and have this customer paying us. But is it really worth the investment that we're going to make in doing this thing for this one customer? Does it apply to all of our customers? How long will it take? Does it take us off of other strategic and tactical things that we're working on? Sometimes the answer is yes, but oftentimes I feel like the answer is no. Sometimes you have to say, okay, this is our plan. We're going to do this for 6 months or a year, and we're going to stick to it. And then maybe you make a course adjustment, right? So it's, it's kind of like two ends of like the same spectrum. It's like over here, there's a lot of resistance and very slow change. And then over here, there's like, okay, let's change right away and let's like redo everything and rethink everything right now. It's like, oh, maybe not. Let's like stick to our guns for a little while and let's see how this goes before we go and just make changes mid-flight. I think a phrase that I used to like, still use occasionally, is changing the engine on airplane while it's flying, right? It's like, do we really want to change the engine on the airplane while it's mid-flight? Is this a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think great wisdom there for any startup as well. You know, it has to be commercial, you know, make commercial sense and don't get too excited at the prospect, but take a step back and assess, you know, holistically the bigger picture.
Well, Stephen, I think one thing that's happening right now, which I'm seeing a lot, both when I read articles and when I'm on Twitter and stuff, is the interest in artificial intelligence has been like re-sparked big time, as you know, with what OpenAI is doing with ChatGPT. Now, like everyone is like, oh no, we need to have some AI in our product right away. It's like, okay, yes, you do, but it's, you know, you don't want to just keep pouring fuel on that fire until it burns your house down, right? It's like, look at it from a measured point of view. Is what we're doing, can it really use AI? Probably. To what degree do you want to jump in with both feet right now? That's the big question, right? So we can talk about ChatGPT-4 and OpenAI and all that kind of stuff at length if you like. But from either even a big company and a small company point of view, it's like, yeah, I mean, things will change, but it's not like it's going to change overnight and that 50% of the tech jobs are going to disappear by this time next year, right? That's just not going to happen, right? If you follow some people on Twitter, they'll be like, oh, everything's going to change. All devs will be, you know, laid off within a year. Not all devs. 50% of devs will be gone because ChatGPT can just write your code and everything. It's like, actually, not really. it's one of those things, right? It's like when the cloud came along, we no longer had this heavy process and time frame for being able to deploy things. But if you think about it, like from 10 years ago to now, when, you know, cloud was on the rise and we had all this automation and DevOps and stuff like that, did it really cause the number of developers needed to go down substantially? I mean, you work in staffing. I think you could answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, totally. Totally.
It'll just be another tool in your tool belt, right?
Exactly.
AI will be another tool in your tool belt. It'll make you more productive and more efficient. You can do more, probably. Maybe your company won't hire as many people in the future over the next year, 2 years or 5 years, but they will probably still need to hire people to keep up with the pace of innovation that happens because of competition, right?
So. Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's your approach to that particular subject and your mindset. And Anderson, actually, you spoke about OpenAI because it's something which I might get onto towards the end here. So,
sure.
I'm keen to learn from your point of view, Pratik. What do you feel is the biggest challenge that the industry currently faces, and what will it take to address this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So when I think of the current challenge that we're facing, it is definitely around the layoffs that have been happening around the big tech companies, right? All the Fang or whatever they call it now, right? So that's made a lot of noise recently. And what's interesting for me is that I've been reading a lot of articles recently where these big companies, Meta, Google, Microsoft, etc., they all overhired during the pandemic, or that's what their CEOs say, at least, right? Because they, you know, during the pandemic, tech took off like a rocket ship straight up. And they're like, oh no, we're going to need a whole bunch of people to be able to keep up with this demand. And I do actually believe when you see someone like Mark Zuckerberg or Sundar Pichai from Google say that, yes, that's our fault, we overhired, right? Because they were looking at this in terms of what their growth was going to look like. But they didn't accommodate for the fact that, well, eventually the party's going to stop, and then what are we going to do, right? And that's where we're at now. For the big tech companies, the party has kind of stopped, and like they're shrinking in size. They're not shrinking dramatically, right? Everyone, if you go out into social media and Twitter, it feels like the sky is falling, right? That there's like no jobs in tech. And yes, we're in a little bit of a lull right now. I personally believe that it will stabilize, or it already has started to stabilize a little bit. but there are plenty of other jobs out there, right? They may not be the fancy, you know, Google job that you wanted, or, you know, I don't know, Meta, whoever, right? All the big tech companies have a lot of cachet because of all the great perks and everything they provide, as well as the generous compensation that they provide. So it may not be the good old days, as we like to think about it, when, you know, in 2001, things were like crazy and people were getting hired very quickly with gigantic pay packages. But there are jobs out there, right? And I'm sure you know that, since you work in the recruitment space. There's plenty of jobs out there, right? If you are a developer who has kept up your skills, it doesn't matter which specific technology platform you work on, whether you work on Java like I do, whether you work on front end with Vue.js, whether you're doing Python, right? It doesn't have to be something cool and sexy that you need to learn right now, like machine learning and AI. I feel like, and you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, I feel like there's plenty of jobs for people who are Python devs and web JavaScript devs and Java devs and et cetera, right? They're at smaller companies or medium companies, or like I mentioned before, some of those non-exciting companies like AT&T, who I mentioned before, right? So there's still great jobs out there. You not only will you survive, I feel like that you can take one of these jobs and be happy and do quite well with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anything particular, you know, it's sort of changed the mindset into people who are perhaps risk adverse by choosing these larger, perhaps well-known established businesses. It's actually opening up a different pathway for them to explore. And you're right, there's so much great stuff going on at that small to medium size, you know, sector, with some incredible growth too. So yeah, totally agree. I want to move on to talking talent. Sure. I want to maybe make this a bit generic, because I know you've obviously built several teams and you've been involved in several hiring processes. From your experience, how do you identify exceptional talent, and what key traits would you look for? And then the flip side of that, once you have successfully onboarded great engineers, how would you retain them?
Okay. So let's tackle the first part of that question, which is how do you identify good talent? So as someone who has interviewed many, many people over the years and hired many people over the years, when I am looking to hire a software developer, software engineer, I look for a lot of the common things that everybody else looks for, right? The ability to be able to code, number one. And I'll come back to a quick story on that in just a second. But the ability to code and not just be able to hack code, right? Someone who is a professional software engineer, because I don't want to hire someone who's a quote unquote code hacker onto my team, right? I don't mean from a security point of view, but someone who just kind of flies by the seat of their pants and writes code and doesn't write unit tests and stuff like that, right? That's not the kind of person I want. I want someone who can put together a mental plan, or even a plan on paper, for how they're going to build out a feature, how they're going to write this code, that they have the ability to understand and adhere to whatever software process is used. And I don't mean like Agile or Scrum or anything like that. I mean at a low level, right? It's how do they approach writing code, right? Do they think in a test-driven development, TDD style, right? Do they think about low-level code architecture, right? There's high-level architecture, and then there's low-level code architecture, of course, right? Someone who can write good, maintainable code that everybody understands. I hate it when people write code that is super elaborate, because it makes it much more difficult for somebody else to understand and somebody else to maintain, because there are very few shops where there's just one developer, right? Most shops have at least two or three or five or 10 or 20 developers. So that's what I look for at kind of the coding level, right? And the other thing I like to look for is that this person is organized and has consistency in terms of that, the way that they approach software engineering. Okay. Yes, of course, there's lots of little caveats here, but is someone able to think through a problem and then say, okay, this is how I'm going to approach this, and then this is how I'm going to do checking this code? How often do they check in code? That may be something that seems surprising, but when One of the things that I like to see is people checking in code frequently into the source code repository, into Git, right? I don't like to see big bang check-ins where there's literally hundreds of lines of codes being checked in at once, because that makes everything much more difficult, as you understand. So those are the two low-level kinds of things. And then there's the, you know, that is a natural progression into overall teamwork, right? How does this person work with other people on the team? If this person is a senior plus developer, do they take the time, or have they demonstrated in the past that they take the time to help mentor mid to junior developers? For me, that's almost like an automatic hire, right? If that person shows that they care about helping the mid and junior people on their team to become better, or take time to explain things, whatever it may be, for me, that's like a huge win, right? Because that's what we need, is we need that cohesive teamwork where it's not, and it has to be done in a way that's empathetic and respectful, of course. It's not like, oh, this code is absolute rubbish, you know, you need to go rewrite it. That's not helpful, right? What's more helpful is something like, well, let's think about how we can make this code better, right? You're using this ternary operator three times in this one block of code. Maybe let's simplify that into three different if-else statements so it's more readable. Stuff like that, that helps, again, mid to junior level devs to write more maintainable code. Teamwork, low-level code. And I know that occasionally you'll go out onto Twitter or social media, and every so often, like clockwork, like every 3 months, someone will say, if your GitHub open source contributions don't look like this green tile, then I'm not interested, right? But not everybody has the ability to work on personal open source projects, whether they just don't have the time, or they just don't have the interest, or maybe they're working at a company that doesn't allow them to contribute to open source like that, right? It's like, that's all a bunch of noise. It's like, I don't really care if someone's contributed. If they have, that's nice. I'll go look at their code. I'll go look at their contributions. You know, that can possibly be a plus, but I try to make sure that if they're contributing to some kind of open source project like that, I don't necessarily use that to weigh one candidate higher than another one, because everyone's circumstance is different, right? Like, you know, do I do a bunch of open source contributions right now? No, because I honestly don't have time. I have other stuff I work on, right? They don't show up on GitHub, but they show up in other places, right? Mm-hmm. So a direct example for that would be, how do you compare someone who has a bunch of open source contributions to someone who volunteers at their local Java user group or their local JavaScript meetup? They're still putting in time in some way and investing in themselves by doing something outside of work. How do you weigh those two things? For me, I weigh them equally, right? Yeah. So, and for me, a lot of times, it's the people skills that really matter, even for software developers. Because yes, some software developers are able to go sit in the corner, the proverbial corner, and hack code and, like, you know, do awesome things, and that's great. That person still needs to be managed properly. Their code has to integrate with everybody else's code. So, you know, even though you may have a cowboy sitting there in the corner doing that, that's not enough. They still need to be able to go to the business analyst and say, hey, you know, this thing that you've asked me to do, I don't think this is quite right. Let's do it like this, because I think it makes more sense, right? That kind of thing. So anyways, a very long-winded answer to the first part of your question. But there's a myriad of different things that come in there. And if you will, let me comment on one more thing. Mm-hmm. There's also this almost like diametric spectrum of, should candidates be put through a coding exercise of some kind when they are interviewing? Now, I have two minds on this, right? So I've done the gauntlet, or the meat grinder, whatever you want to call it, at a couple of FAANG type companies where you do the coding thing, and there's multiple of these coding things, right? It's extremely stressful, right? Watching, forget about an interview. Like, I know pair programming is a thing, but I personally am not a huge fan of pair programming, because I don't like to have somebody watch over my shoulder while I'm coding, right? I mean, I think I know how to code. I'm reasonably well versed in writing code, but it's just putting the additional pressure that your job, you getting this job, depends on whether or not you can perform with the spotlight on you. It doesn't make sense, right? It would be like me asking you, "Hey, Stephen, we'd like for you to come and audition to play at Manchester United." Sorry, what's your football club?
Yeah, United. So you got it right there.
Okay. All right. So we'd like for you to come and audition to play at Manchester United. You want to come and do it in front of, like, you know, all the coaches and all the players, versus, "Hey, we saw you playing at your local club team. You know, I don't know where you live in London, but I'll just make something up in Hackney. And you were doing an awesome job. You're in your natural environment playing with your buddies. And they saw you playing footy and they were like, wow, this guy can really bend a ball, right? Let's get this guy up for whatever, right?" So it's kind of that, if you want to use a sports analogy, it's kind of that kind of sports analogy. It's like, does the coding interview really help you discern a really good developer versus someone who's not so good? I don't think so. With that said, coding tests that I've given in the past, I tell the candidate up front that this is what we're going to do. I'm going to have you write a object that has some fields in it. It'll be a simple thing with 3 to 5 different fields in it. And then I want you to write a JUnit test that exercises that specific object. So that is something myself personally, I could do in 5 minutes. And, you know, this is something I ran by some friends who are good developers. I said, "Hey, how long would you take you to complete this coding test?" Right. And I think the key there is that that's something I can do in 5 minutes. And when a candidate is doing it, they do it on their own without somebody watching them and peppering them with questions the whole time. Like, "Hey, but what about this? Or what if you did that?" Right. But OK, here you go. And my goal there is just to demonstrate that they understand basic coding constructs, and they understand how to write a unit test around it, which I don't think the bar is very high there, right? It's like, can this person write a user object in the Java language with these fields? Do they know what getters and setters are, et cetera, et cetera? And can they then write a unit test that checks these kinds of things, right? So it's not like a super hard coding test, but it verifies the basics. And then afterwards, you can look at their code. Again, the key here is afterwards, and say, "Okay, you chose to write this unit test like this. Why did you do that? There's not a right or wrong answer here, but explain to me your style and how you approach this." So that helps, at least from my point of view as the interviewer, that helps for me to understand that this person, first of all, knows how to code. And it also gives me a little bit deeper insight into how they approach and they think about coding, right? So that helps to separate out and give differentiation between the different candidates that are applying for a position, right? And it's, again, it's not overly taxing. I don't think it's putting too much stress on the candidate to be able to do that, or ask them to do something like this, especially that they know up front, so they can, you know, I would say that no candidate would really need to prepare for something like that. But if they want to, sure, it's like they can pull up a documentation. Okay, how do I write an object in Java? How do I write a unit test in Java just so it's uploaded into my brain when I'm giving this code test? And then it helps the interviewer to say, "Okay, yeah, this person knows how to code at a basic level." The real information comes afterwards when you can ask them how they approach it, what their style of coding is and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's definitely a preferred interview method that we see on the other side of the table. And I think there's so many companies have missed out on great talent, you know, due to these timed, you know, coding sessions and the pressure. And as you mentioned, the questions, go in your own space, do your thing, come back, let's discuss your approach, and then take it from there. Yeah, no, beautiful. Refreshing to hear that too. So yeah, I suppose then the second half of the question then is, once you have identified and onboarded, in your experience then, how would you retain great talent?
Oh, that's easy. You just throw them in the deep end of the pool and hope they swim. I'm joking, of course. The retaining the talent part, I think more than anything else, because of the industry we work in, and of course you're familiar with this because you work on the staffing side, and you know, you talk both to the employer and the person who will become the employee, is Software developers will work for small to large amounts of money, but they will stay somewhere if they feel like they are being productive, they feel like they have skin in the game, meaning they feel like they're a member of the team, they feel like they're being heard, their issues or the things that they want to bring up, which they feel are important, are heard and also addressed, right? Can't always address everything, right? Someone on team may say, hey, I know we're using this great framework right now, but I saw this thing the other day and I hacked out a project with it and it's amazing. Let's start using it. Well, okay, no, right? You can't take a team of 20 people and just turn on a dime and start using this other great thing. Yeah, sure. Let's, if you want to do that, come up with the plan. Tell me why this thing is great. Tell me how it will help our team. Tell us how it will help the business. And then let's have a serious discussion about it, right? Anyways. I'm getting sidetracked there, but you see what I'm saying there. But so from a retention point of view, it's that. And I think the one thing that a lot of employers, managers, whatever, miss is they don't account for personal growth, not just from climbing the career ladder type of thing. Yeah, sure, you want to go from junior to mid to senior, whatever, right? Yes, you know, every employee wants that progression because obviously that is tied to compensation, right? But again, compensation isn't everything, right? Has my manager or my employer invested in me to be able to be at the top of my game? Okay. And this doesn't necessarily apply to the people who you would consider to be top performers, right? Not just to the top performers. Everybody on the team, I feel like, needs to have some time or some kind of investment that comes from their manager or their employee to help them stay on top of all the latest tech, to learn the latest methodologies. And, you know, it's hard because everybody has deadlines, right? It's like, we have to get this project out next month, you know, whatever. On May 30th, we're doing this big drop. Okay, now that you've done this big release and you've gotten over the hump, you've ironed out some of the bugs, things are smooth sailing, we're going to start working on the next iteration or sprint or whatever methodology you use. But have you factored in there like, hey, maybe I can give my employees, you know, not all at the same time, but staged over time, how can I give my employees sometimes so that they can go and work on something that they're interested in? Or that guy who said, hey, let's use this new framework. It's like, hey, you know what, Stephen, go and take this Thursday and Friday. You don't have to work on any of our code. Put together a plan for that. Let's see a prototype. Come back next Wednesday and show us, do a small presentation for us. Show us what you learned about this new framework you want to use, right? So it's that kind of investment, right? That's the, you know, that's very difficult to do because, you know, as a manager or as you know, whatever, somewhere higher up in management, you always want to keep people productive, right? To keep adding features for your business, blah, blah, blah. So you have to make sure you carve out, like, you know, even 5% of that person's time over the course of the year, such a small amount, but, you know, 5%, if you say a person works on average 200 days a year out of the 352 days of the year, 5% is what? Right? It's maybe 10 days out of the year, right? Mm-hmm. Even 5 days, 10 to five, 5, 10, 20 days out of the year, you give them a little bit of liberty to go and work on these things. And it doesn't have to be that they work on some little side project and they go and demo it to the team. It could also be, hey, you know what? There's a conference coming up in London. For example, we were talking before the call about DevOps UK. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't cost much. I think it costs like 500 quid to send a developer there. It's a 2 or 3 day conference. Maybe they have some training on something that you're going to use, like, or maybe the employee's interested in something like machine learning and AI, right? Say, hey, we'd like to send you all to this conference. We'll pay for it. You can take 3 days off of work to go to it, right? Something as small as that, right? Where they get to get out of the office, especially nowadays, where people are working remotely most of the time. And, you know, I don't know what it's like in London. Maybe they come into the office once or twice a week and hang out. But it's like, hey, as a whole team, you guys go out to this conference, go learn a whole new bunch of stuff. But as a manager, this is what I like to do as a follow-up to that. It's not just 3 free days off, right? I say that facetiously, of course. Check out a bunch of sessions at this event. Take time to learn some new stuff. go enjoy the after parties at this conference, blah, 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 do some networking, whatever you'd like to do there. But when you come back, I want everybody who's gone to this thing to produce a 1 or 2 page summary of some of the cool stuff that they saw there, something interesting they learned, whatever, right? So it's a little bit of give and take as a manager. It's like, I'd love for you to go to this 3 days, you know, it's not necessarily off. They're off doing stuff, or they're at this event doing something. You know, they're sitting in sessions and absorbing all this information, but I'd like to see what you learn from this, right? So, and what that does for me as a manager then is that when it comes to review time at the end of the year, or whenever you do it, mid-year reviews, I can pull that out and say, okay, so you learned these things at this conference. Did you implement any of these things this year? No? Okay, tell me why. Oh, so you don't really feel like doing this type of framework in our project is worth it, right? But that shows that the manager has a personal interest in that employee's career progression and growth. And the employee also has to put something back onto the table, right? So it has to very much be a two-way street. And I think, you know, and to be honest with you, one of the things that we suffer from in this industry big time, and you may or may not disagree with me on this, is that there are far too many developers who become managers.
Mm.
Being able to code does not mean that you're going to be a good manager. To put it bluntly, right? I know for myself, when I first came into this industry, I was good at coding, but I was a terrible manager. And that's why I never did. It took me a while to get to a point, and I learned things the hard way, unfortunately, like everybody else does, that this is what it means to be a good people manager and to think about things like career growth and to think about, you know, am I putting too much pressure on this person right now? Or should I, like, you know, spread whatever tasks need to be done a little bit more for so that this person can not have so much pressure on them right now? But conversely, when is a good time to say, okay, I need you to step up to the plate. We really need to get this done within the next 2 weeks, right? How, what can I do to help you achieve this goal kind of thing, right? So anyways, I know we've talked about multiple different things there, but hopefully that's interesting for not just the developers, but if there are any managers listening, people first, right? Process and technology second. That's how I approach things.
Yeah, absolutely. And that builds a solid environment of buy-in, autonomy, and personal interest, as you mentioned, Prateek. So thank you for that. We then move on to the Ask the Audience CodeBytes session, which is something which I quite enjoy getting into. Now, probably touched upon this earlier on, but this week we look at AI and chat GPT specifically, and its ability to understand and write neat pieces of code. As exciting as the AI space is, there's some increasing concern amongst developers regarding how future-proof their skills are, you know, within the next era of engineering. Mm-hmm. What simple advice could you give to these developers?
My simple advice is don't panic, but learn to embrace this new tool in your tool belt, right? If I had to summarize it in one sentence, it would be that. So to expand on that just a little bit, the ability for these new AI tools like Copilot and ChatGPT 3.5 and 4 to be able to provide you with solutions and answers to different things. From a very rudimentary perspective for me, it does the busy work of having to scan through many, many pages of Stack Overflow, right? That's from a rudimentary perspective, right? Instead of spending an hour looking through Stack Overflow as to why is this problem happening, I can just go to ChatGPT and say, I have this problem, what's the solution? And at this point in time, it's not bad, right? It's not 100%, but I feel like it's probably somewhere between 50 and 75% good in terms of the solution it provides me to, like, a coding problem. And then of course there's, you know, all the other things it does, right? It's like, I just did an experiment the other day where for the company that I work at, Azul Systems, where I lead the developer relations team, I'm trying to organize the different, like, meetups and webinars and events that myself and the people in my team go and do, right? Online webinars like this, or speaking at a conference or a local meetup. And right now I'm just managing it all in like an Excel spreadsheet, which works, but it's an Excel spreadsheet. So it's a little bit time intensive. So I was like, you know what, let me just spec out the different things that I would want a proper system to have for myself to be able to see what everyone is doing, and for more importantly, the folks on my team to have a like a web interface, web form, where they can say, I'm going to this thing in this date and I'm giving this presentation, blah, 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 right? So I basically just spec'd out like all the fields and what I wanted to do. And amazingly, it produced all the code I needed to be able to build that system. So I was able to copy and paste all that, and boom, I had that system. Like I put it like this. I spent more time thinking about it, right? Like maybe 30 to 45 minutes thinking about all the things I needed. And then I put it in there. And if I would have written it myself, it will probably would have taken somewhere between 3 and 4 hours, but I was able to just spec everything out. And within less than an hour, I had everything I needed for that system to at least get started. Okay. Mm-hmm. So on the surface, that's like, wow, that's amazing. Right. But as you very well know, and as our listeners very well know, or at least I'd like to think them, have them think about this, is how often do you start off with a completely blank slate and a green field system? Very rarely. 99% of your time is maintaining and adding to an existing system, which has a mountain of code complexity and business complexity behind it. So don't worry, ChatGPT-4 is never going to steal your job. Right? It will help you. You have this problem in your code base, boom. Mm. It'll give you an answer in a fraction of the time, rather than you trolling through Google search and Stack Overflow. I want to add this new feature into the system. Okay, here's what the spec looks like. Then you'll get that back. And then you don't necessarily have to write all the code for it, but you still need to integrate it into your existing code. So again, it will help you. It may save you 50%, 75% of your time to do that, which is awesome. But it's not going to fix the ability or the capability of integrating with your existing gigantic code base behind it, right? So again, it's something you have in your back pocket. What's that term that they use in the security space? Trust but verify, right? So sure, go use ChatGPT, generate code. It'll give you the solution, right? That looks pretty good. I'll use this solution. But of course, you need to go verify to make sure it actually does what it's supposed to do, because it won't know the complexity of the stuff that you're working on, right? So anyways.
Valid point. Absolutely valid point, particularly for the more legacy complex coding environments, taking probably using it as a helping hand. You know, it's there for you, not against you, kind of thing.
We
always love wrapping things up. And what advice could you give to any aspiring software engineer in today's current market?
Yeah, so the advice is stay the course, be persistent. Things will be on the upswing sooner rather than later, in my opinion. We're in a little bit of a tech winter right now. It's not as bad as it was back in, 2008 and 2009. So I'm sure you were, in the industry at the time. You know what it was like back then. It was much worse than now, right? And a lot of things are out of your control, right? So as an individual, it's not possible for us to be able to control everything that we have around us. That's just life in general. But when it comes to your career and a job search and stuff like that, you can't control everything, especially the macroeconomic conditions which are going about right now. So there's no point getting depressed, right? Just, stay positive. Continue to build your skills. If you're at a stage right now where you're actively looking for your first job or you're looking to change jobs, just have a little bit of patience. Things will get better sooner rather than later, right? I don't know what sooner rather than later means. It could mean sometime this year. It could mean sometime next year around this time, but it won't be like a 2-5 years or something like that. Because as you know, things move so quickly in our world today, right? So as we saw, I've been keenly interested in what happened recently with both the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and just yesterday of Credit Suisse, you know, both those firms essentially imploding. I don't 100% agree with this, but there's some big person in the finance space or something blamed the collapse of Credit Suisse on social media. And I really just laughed at that because I was like, that is the dumbest crap I've ever heard. I don't want to use too much color on your colorful language or fruity language, as you call it, on your podcast. But I don't believe that crap for a second. I think what it is that people are just hyper-connected today, right? So when things start going sideways, like, you know, in the stock market or for like SVB or Credit Suisse, you might see the chatter on Twitter and social media, but there's a lot of chatter happening that you don't see with everyone, you know, on their Telegram or Signal or text message accounts, people texting each other, right? That's the stuff you don't see happening behind the scenes. Anyways, my point is that things move very quickly nowadays, right? Even governments have adjusted somewhat to that. We want government to move slow. That's what it's there for, right? But when we talk about like monetary policy and things like that, it moves a lot faster than it used to even 10 years ago, especially compared to 20, 30, 40 years ago. So the market for tech people in terms of jobs will recover. Will we see the rah-rah days of 2021? Yeah, it's going to be a long time before we get back to that kind of frenzy, right? If ever. The way that I look at it, things are approaching back to what we would consider to be normal as opposed to insane.
Yeah.
So we just have to keep that reality in mind. Think to yourself, ask a friend who was looking for a job 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. How long did it take you to get that job? How many places did you need to interview? What was the interview process like? And I think that will give you an idea of what it will look like this year, later this year, as things start to improve. We're getting back to those types of more stability types of environments where the job market is coming back. Job market has never left. There are jobs out there in tech. Mm-hmm. If you're a good coder, if you're a good software developer, if you're good at design, doesn't matter. Anything you do in tech, the jobs are still there, right? Maybe not as numerous or not as, maybe the comp packages aren't what they were during 2021, but they're probably comparable to what they were 5 years ago is my guess. Right. So yeah. still not bad. I still love working in this industry. A bunch of my friends work in this industry. Everyone gets well paid. Especially if you look after your career and you look to add to your skills on a continuing basis, you will move up the career ladder, right? You may start off small with a small comp package, but you'll get there. Right? It might take a little bit of time, right? Yeah. But you know, it's still, you know, if it's not for you, it's not for you. If you don't like sitting in front of a computer for 6 to 8 hours a day or more, then, you know, you should definitely look at something else. But there are very few jobs where you can sit inside an air-conditioned environment, solve fun problems if you find those problems to be fun and get paid relatively well for it.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Pratik, and a great source of wisdom there. Pratik, I am going to plug on the show notes everything a bit about you regards to ATL and DevNexus and stuff like that. But if people want to find out what you're doing within your world, how could they go about doing this?
Yeah, pretty easy. Just follow me on Twitter at PRPATEL. I post mostly jokes and pictures of stuff coming out of my home kitchen, i.e. when I'm cooking. But I do occasionally also post about some of the tech stuff that I'm working on or some event that I'll be at. Like we were talking earlier, I'm looking forward to coming to London in May 10th through 12th for DevOps UK, mostly so I can do a curry crawl down Brick Lane or something like that.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'll hopefully see you there as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Pratik, this has been an absolutely amazing episode. Thank you so much for your advice and hearing your incredible journey. And hope to hear from you soon.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. I had a lot of fun talking to you all.